Portland, 90.7 FM, all community radio, all the time.
KVU Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KVU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KVU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library in Portland. The reception is an opportunity to tour the exhibit, which illustrates the Black philanthropic experience, hear from exhibit creators, and connect with social justice movement leaders from across Portland. Again, that's the opening reception for Giving Back, the Soul of Philanthropy, reframed and exhibited Tuesday, January 13th at 6 p.m. at Concordia University's George R. White Library, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As we come marching at the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of gray, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Oh, hear the people singing.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KVU airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression, all this, and we have fun. I'm your host tonight, Cheryl Green. Our engineer is Adam, and my guest tonight is Talila T.L. Lewis. Talila T.L. Lewis has been named a White House Champion of Change and was also named one of the top 30 thinkers under 30 by Pacific Standard in 2015. Talila is an attorney, organizer, and visiting professor who founded and works with the all-volunteer organization HEARD, which stands for Helping Educate to Advance the Rights of Deaf Communities. HEARD focuses on correcting and preventing deaf wrongful convictions, ending abuse of incarcerated people with disabilities, decreasing recidivism rates for deaf-returned citizens, and increasing representation of deaf people in professions that can counter mass incarceration and end the attendant school-to-prison pipeline. Talila created the only national database of deaf-incarcerated individuals. This is something that jails and prisons aren't tracking themselves. Talila also maintains contact with hundreds of deaf-incarcerated individuals. TL also leads intersectional campaigns that advance the rights of multiply marginalized people, including the hashtag Deaf in Prison campaign, the Deaf Prisoner Phone Justice campaign, and the American Civil Liberties Union's Know Your Deaf Rights campaign. Talila doesn't work in isolation, but in a place of interdependence and community, amplifying the work of others in the various communities Talila belongs to and advocates for and with. The show page and transcript will have a link to the syllabus TL created and uses for a class called Disability Justice in the Age of Mass Incarceration. There will also be a link to an interview TL did with Sarika Mehta's Intersections Radio in the second episode in a series called Deaf Injustice, where they talk much more in depth about HEARD's work and rights and justice for deaf and disabled people who are incarcerated. Today's interview and Sarika's interview are both transcribed.
I'm a visiting professor at Rochester Institute of Technology, but also National Technical Institute for the Deaf, which is one of the 9 colleges that's housed at RIT.
How long will you be teaching there or working there?
I'm not sure. You know, I tend to be a person who goes where I'm needed. So if someone calls me elsewhere, I'll go. Because I think that the information that I share with folks, it shouldn't stay in one location.
You work with communities who are deaf, deaf-blind, deaf-disabled, and hard of hearing. You work in a lot of communities. I think larger society feels like all of this is just somebody's personal problem or shortcoming or medical condition. They just need to fix it. But you look at systemic and institutionalized oppression and creating justice. And I'd love if you talk about maybe unpacking those assumptions and how you work.
The first assumption that I'd like to lay to rest, this one assumption, and that's that any individual in any of the communities in which I live or work, so whether we're talking about the trans and gender non-conforming communities, the deaf, deaf-blind, deaf-disabled, hard-of-hearing communities, the disabled or blind communities, and the list continues, Black and people of color, low or no income, you name it. I mean, there's all of these different societally forced marginalized communities. Often we'll just term a community a marginalized community. And this isn't the assumption I want to lay to rest, but I guess it is one that I will lay to rest. That the onus is not on those individuals to rid themselves of this oppression, right? The onus is on all of those individuals around them who have literally laid to waste their bodies and their communities and their hearts and their dreams and all of these things that we know get crushed by this mass marginalization of so many communities. So I guess I'll start there. But the assumption that I was talking about initially is the assumption that all of these communities are single issue communities. So often when someone says disabled, everyone's like, oh, wheelchair user. When someone says deaf, they're like, oh, you know, Niall DeMarco, you know, the white dancing, famous deaf person, but always white, right? It's very, very normalized to think white everything. Everything is white. Everyone is white. And it's dangerous to our communities. So even when you look at the LGBTQI communities, the trans and gender nonconforming communities, the problem with this assumption that everything is white, everyone is white, is that the intersectional issues get not just erased or glossed over, but in fact, they almost always purposefully get put on the back burner. We'll handle that race issue a little bit later after we handle the access component for deaf and disability communities. We'll handle that race issue after we get same-sex marriage. So these sorts of conversations that really just are direct forms of violence from within the communities that allegedly are representative of the larger swath of the community, which is always going to be multiply intersectional for a number of reasons. So I think the single issue assumption and the white assumption are the two assumptions that I think are most critical to throw out the window and really get our gears turning and thinking a lot more critically. I call it critical intersectionality. Because I think this word has now just become kind of so common, at least in a lot of spaces, and people throw it out. But are people actually practicing critical intersectionality? Are people really unpacking constantly? Not so much, not even in a lot of the communities that are some of the most quote-unquote activist. And I'll give an example of that. And this is not to in any way demean or devalue the work of a lot of these entities, right? I want to say that up front. Often people think when you present issues or problems with approaches to advocacy that you are somehow, devaluing the work that has been done. And that's not at all what it is. When people present concerns about different advocacy approaches, it's really out of love. And I think that love should be centered in everything that we do. And so I want to call out, and I've had direct conversations with the folks involved in this organization, Black Lives Matter, obviously have done amazingly critical work. And in a lot of ways, they are encompassing a lot of the different intersections that we'll find in our different communities, Black trans communities, Black LGBTQI communities, Black women, but also, you know, other communities, other intersections of the Black communities, Black Muslim community, and so on and so forth. The one community that tends to always be left out of the conversation with Black Lives Matter is Black disabled individuals. And if you know anything about oppression, structural and systemic oppression, and how it works, you understand that ableism, autism, sanism, so those are discriminations based on perceived ability or ability, based on perceived ability to hear, inability to hear and or speak, and also based on alleged mental health status, perceived or real. So those are those three, ableism, autism, and sanism. That's what they mean in brief. Those are the things that get glossed over. But what's critically important is that those oppressions, any sort of ability-based oppression, is structurally rooted in racism and is structurally rooted in classism. And of course, all of these oppressions have all sorts of interplay. They depend on one another, and they can't live without the other. That being said, if you address one or two without addressing ableism, you're actually just not going to make any headway. And that's because they are literally inextricably linked. And so a lot of the more, even the more progressive groups, coalitions, collectives are really just missing this memo about true critical intersectionality and disability solidarity.
Yeah. I recently read an open letter from the Harriet Tubman Collective. Are you in that collective?
Yes, I played a role in drafting that letter. Yeah. A lot of people actually struggled with the level that it was written at. So that's one of our critiques of ourselves is like, how can we be more accessible? We thought we were doing a pretty good job, but we didn't quite hit it. So, you know, even asking those kinds of questions, like, what can we do better? So the Harriet Tubman Collective is a group of all Black, deaf, disabled, deafblind individuals who are really actively seeking liberation through disability solidarity. So disability solidarity is all communities working toward disability justice and intersectional justice. So focusing on making sure that the disability community is working toward racial and economic justice, working to dismantle other, you know, oppressive structures and systems, while simultaneously holding all communities accountable. So civil rights organizations, for example, or collectives that focus on economic justice, holding all of ourselves accountable for disability justice. It's making sure that everyone is accountable to everyone. Our originating group is 17 people in the collective, and we work together to create what we called Completing the Vision for Black Lives in response to the Movement for Black Lives platform, the Vision for Black Lives, which came out and discussed a number of policy and issues that they want to be addressed and very specific areas in which they wanted society to pay attention and take action. And they named a number of different marginalized groups, and what was left out was disability. And so all of us Black disabled activists called them in, and we had some conversations about it. And we were asking that they change the language and include disability in the platform statement, because this is a statement that's now being distributed across the world at this point, right? And it's lacking a critical disability justice lens. So it was our response to say, you know, Black disabled people are disproportionately represented in perpetually impoverished communities, underserved education-wise communities, in police brutality, in carceral settings, and not just by a small margin. We're talking a huge disproportionate representation of people with disabilities, and each of those are in the foster care system. I don't like calling it foster care. We need to find another term for that. In some states, California, it's a 75% rate of people who are incarcerated previously were wards of the state in the foster care system. Again, why we don't need to be calling it foster care. Obviously, something's not going right there. So anywho, all of these things are connected, right? And I think that's, the point of this conversation. It'll all come back to this interconnectedness of all of these oppressions and how they play on one another, how they depend on one another, and how we can't achieve liberation without discussing any. And finally, and most importantly, how erasure of disability is an act of violence. Our response to the Movement for Black Lives platform, completing the vision for Black Lives, was really bringing this other perspective that is critical to understanding the society, to understanding oppression, and to moving forward to collective liberation.
Thank you for bringing the context in. And I will link to that letter in the episode transcript and on the show page too. Ableism really is a very powerful tool for white supremacy. And one of the ways that we as white people can subjugate people of color is to say, you are less than, you have some kind of disability just in your inherent being. You are less smart. You are less capable in this, that. I mean, we just give somebody a disability in order to justify, well, of course they're inferior. And so it's always been a tool all the way back from diagnoses like drapetomania to the present day, where we as white people keep trying to reinforce a standard of goodness or normalcy that will always exclude anyone who's not white by default.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important to name that scientific racism and scientific ableism are essentially one and the same. So while they, you know, at least on their face, theoretically, are discussing different quote unquote constructed identities, really, you can't separate the two. So the eugenicist movement that really Nazi Germany pulled from the United States, which often people kind of gloss over that or miss it all together, and everybody wants to point at, you know, all of these other countries and their mass genocidal campaigns. White men here in the United States created scientific oppression, scientific genocide, scientific categories that created the standards of quote-unquote normalcy. Like, to understand the history of this United States of America, these United States, it's impossible to understand it without understanding and naming disability, race, and class, at least. Like, those are the very bare minimum of what we would need to be unpacking and understanding. Like, even when you look at understanding enslavement, when you understand forced familial separation, when you understand mass genocide, when you understand mass incarceration, how can you not discuss disability in that and intergenerational trauma, right? And so trauma is a cause and consequence of disability. Poverty is a cause and consequence of trauma. And the cycle just continues and repeats itself. That's the missing component of all of our struggles for liberation, is this erasure of disability, the subjugating of disability, the hiding of disability, instead of honoring it as a full and complete part of who most of us, if you've been perpetually oppressed, are. Even like when you look at health outcomes and access to quote unquote health care, mental health care, poverty, disability, and race are all implicated. Even when you look at diagnosis, so whether it's a diagnosis, a misdiagnosis, or a non-diagnosis, all of those are rooted in classism, ableism, and racism. Most of the time, for example, news media or even quote-unquote activists, when I try to have these conversations with them, it's, oh, you know, you're just getting into the weeds. You know, or, you know, I'm not sure that it's actually that intertwined, or ableism. I'm not sure how we, nah, I don't think we really need to get to that at this point. We really need to focus on racism. So a lot of the same kind of excuses that white people have used to kind of push back our day of liberation as far as racial equality and economic equality go. It's the same excuses that we're hearing from white and black and, you know, other people of color about why ableism isn't a big deal. That sort of kind of dismissal is pretty common and really, really detrimental and violent and exhausting for all of us who are in the space trying to work toward all of our liberation. Yeah.
On one of your blog posts, you have a list of questions that groups can ask themselves. Okay, I'm a group doing racial justice. Am I being anti-ableist too? And here I'm a disability-related group. Am I being anti-racist? And you're not saying, here I am, I have all your answers and solutions, but putting the tools in people's hands to understand why this is a collective thing.
Yeah, thanks for naming that. I've got a group of all Black and POC, deaf and deaf blind and deaf disabled individuals working on an ASL translation of that with me right now. So I'm really, really, I'm just so humbled and so thankful for their hands and their hearts and their contributions to this project and really just believing in the vision and supporting my work and my efforts and really supporting one another and honoring one another through this work. It's been several months that we've been working on this project. So there must be more than 20 deaf and deaf blind people from all across the nation who have contributed in translating that English article that you're referencing into sign to make it accessible. We all need the ASL video. Like, who doesn't need an ASL video about social justice? Like, right when you think about it, it's like, why wouldn't you do that? If someone tells you there's a way for you to make your content actually accessible to everyone, wow, mind blowing. Yes, go. How do we do it? And because I'm actually in community, I'm able to reach out and say, here's the project that I'm working on. Does anyone have the capacity, the interest, the willingness? I'm happy to pay. I like to pay people of color for their time because I know it never happens. And in this case, I offer, I said, you know, I would like to pay you all. I don't want you all just working for free. Your labor and your time is important and valuable. And in this capitalistic society, I would like to pay you. But if I'm in community, and they said, TL, like, no, we're honored. Let's go. Let's do this together. It's not just the translation of the article. We're developing a social justice ASL terminology glossary in English for all of us people who need to learn it from English to sign and also in sign language. So, and that's all part of the process, right? And like, that's beautiful. And that's what this is about. It's about the journey. It's about the community. It's about the love that envelops us throughout that course. It's about what we learn about ourselves and others. It's about collaboration across the lines. And I guess the second related point to that is how me and others who are on the ground doing the work or experiencing the violence and trauma, when we present it, we're often met with the comments of, where's the source for that? How do you know that? Is there anything written on that that you can share with me so I can understand it better and understand what really is going on? And it's like this devaluing of stories, of narratives, of lived experiences, complete injustice, complete violence, erasure of our whole existence, right? For folks who are experiencing the trauma, why is my story not source enough for you? Why is that mother's story not source enough for you? Why is this advocate's story not source enough for you? The stories that don't have enough sources don't get any attention. No one will bring cases, so it can't ever be documented or memorialized, and it disappears into the abyss as though it never happened, and then it continues to happen. And I mean, again, these cycles are not new. Nothing has changed in centuries, and I'm not sure, other than to get folks like yourself who are in places of privilege on board with stopping and, you know, the violence and unpacking, how we can end that cycle. So a lot of the work that I do is trying to disrupt these cycles of violence through and through, right? Not just one space or the other, but like every single area, all of us need to be working on ourselves, which will actually heal the entire world.
I feel like when you look at, well, first of all, around disability, everybody thinks that all disability community wants is services and access to services. But then the people funding the services and the people giving the services are primarily white and often non-disabled, and writing their missions about a group or groups that they're not part of.
When you look at the struggle for liberation, Black liberation, trans liberation, etc., what we understand is that the assumptions around those struggles for liberation are very similar to the assumptions around disability. What do people with disabilities want? Oh, those services. Just make sure they've got the ramp. Just make sure they have that interpreter, which really, let's be clear, another one of my large frustrations about the approach to understanding disability is the assumption that the disability belongs to the individual, when really the disability, frankly, belongs to the entire community. Why? Because the deaf person's mind and information is critically important to the entire community. And if you are a non-signing individual or you're not communicating in a way that works for the entire community, then that means the community is suffering. That means the access need belongs to the community. If you can't communicate one way, why would the onus be on the individual who communicates a different way, as opposed to saying, you know, I think we need an interpreter, not you, not me. We collectively need an interpreter in this space so I can understand you, you can understand me, and we can all get free, right? To me, it's so simple. But this conversation about services, it's not about services for any one of these different marginalized populations or multiply marginalized populations. It's really all about liberation. How can we get free? What does freedom look like to you? And I think that's the question we should be asking all of these different communities and all these communities that have these intersecting identities. I mean, because if you ask that question and you get the right answers to those questions, which, right, everyone's going to have a different vision and dream of freedom and liberation, and that's great. Then it's like, how can we all work together toward all of those visions of freedom and liberation? And I think that's the critical question that tends to not get asked, right? Because it's like you said, everyone's making the decisions for the marginalized populations. The people in positions of power don't belong to marginalized populations. You know, it's not just good enough to have good intentions, because impact is everything, right? I'd rather you just leave everyone alone than to come in high and mighty, riding your horse with no humility, without having unpacked your privileges. Liberation. Liberation. We should all just repeat again and again, freedom and liberation. What is that to you?
So talking about how people with disabilities and deaf people are overrepresented in foster care, that system, but also in jails and prisons. Can you talk about the interaction of deafness and disability with the school to prison pipeline in particular?
So the first thing that I'll say is in the adult prison population, last I checked, no less than 60% of the adult prison population is illiterate. And when you look at kid prisons, what we're looking at is a percentage point of, last I checked, 85% illiteracy, not literacy, illiteracy. What that easily, without even kind of expanding more, is indicating to me, at least, as a person who works with young people, as a person who works in deaf and disability communities, who sees the lack of access to education that has always occurred for disabled and deaf populations, particularly disabled and deaf children, babies, and youth of color, is that what we're talking about in the carceral system is lack of access to opportunities, education, lack of access to understanding of the individual child, what their learning style is, what disabilities they do or don't have, quote unquote disabilities, right? Differences in learning, differences in approaches to how their mind functions, et cetera. And that not being understood leads to criminalization of our children at very young ages. So in New York, Black children make up 18% of the preschool population, preschool, right? So they come to about your knee, right? They're tiny little children, beautiful minds that are ready to learn and ready to just explore the world. 18% are Black children in New York. 48% of children who are preschoolers who are suspended in New York are Black children, right? And those are the children who have more than one suspension. So the percentage point for one suspension would be higher. But unpacking that statistic requires not just that we ask, right, what's up with this disproportionality in suspension, but two, why are we suspending preschoolers, right? And three, what's going on with disability or so-called disability in that section of children who are being penalized for existing, right? Like, we have to be clear about this. Like, oh, we penalized them because they were not following instruction. No, no, no. You literally penalized these children because they were breathing, because there's no reason, regardless of the age, to be suspending, expelling, and arresting children. And that's what we're doing all across the nation. So I believe we can fill up 47 Super Bowl stadiums a year with suspended children. This is completely unacceptable. And so it's this punishment, it's this punitive culture that we're obsessed with here in the United States that really doesn't work. What works with children, what works with all humans, is love. That's what works if we're trying to make sure that people are healthy, that communities are healthy, that communities stay together and stay strong. We don't need police. We don't need zero tolerance policies in schools. What all of those things do is actually further oppress people, make it more difficult for children to be able to learn successfully. And if you happen to be a child with multiply marginalized identities, particularly if you're a student with disabilities, restraint and seclusion is used against you disproportionately, which is traumatizing, which leads to more disability, which means it's harder for you to go to class because why would you want to show up at school when you're being abused? It means that you're being expelled disproportionately, arrested disproportionately, suspended disproportionately, that you're not having the same number of days in class as your peers, that the educational content that you should be getting, you're not getting because maybe now you've been pushed off to another type of class that you shouldn't be in, simply because you've been labeled as allegedly disabled, as allegedly having quote unquote special needs, which there is no such thing as special needs. But I don't want to get into that. But you understand my point. The point is that disabled children, especially disabled children with other marginalized identities, are being penalized literally for existing in all of our schools. It's really heartbreaking, and it's so avoidable. The nation prior to settler colonialism, like, none of this violence actually existed. I think naming the violence that imperialism, colonialism, racism has exacted upon all of our communities, including white communities, which I think is what's even more disturbing, is that white people think they're exempt from the violence that comes down as a result of this perpetual oppression, you know. But I think several of our great thinkers and culture leaders have made clear that white supremacy is not just damaging to Black and brown communities, it's particularly damaging to white people who actually begin to buy into the myth of white supremacy. I think having conversations about that and unpacking what is the impact on white communities, particularly marginalized white people and marginalized white communities, is important in moving forward, as well as we try to unpack and discuss and realize disability justice and disability solidarity.
If you're just tuning in, this is Bread and Roses at KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Cheryl Green. I'm talking to social justice engineer and attorney activist Talila T.L. Lewis about disability solidarity and taking a critical intersectional view of mass incarceration of deaf, deaf-blind, deaf-disabled, and hard-of-hearing people, especially people of color. The song is Sunset in a Day by Prudence Mabena. You really value and uplift the contributions of young people. And when you teach, you don't refer to your students as students, but you refer to them as co-creators of the classes, using language to dismantle some of the power dynamics in classrooms. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you address these dynamics in the classroom and how you disrupt dynamics. And I'm interested how your co-creators respond to being seen as co-creators.
Yeah, words matter. So I call my students either co-creators or co-leaders, depending on the day, depending on how I feel. And I'm sure that will transform and evolve over time, right? I'm sure there's probably some, you know, some sort of structural concerns about that as well, right? The idea of creating and leading, maybe there's some other terminology, but I think that's what's beautiful about the way my mind works, which many people would call it a disabled mind. But I think a lot of folks who are neurodivergent understand that our minds are beautiful and just different. And that's great and should be honored. But so my mind is constantly thinking and rethinking and packing and unpacking and learning and relearning and unlearning. And that's great. So co-leaders or co-creators of class, too often you see people in positions of power, which is anyone who, quote unquote, has the power to lead a class, take for granted the critical importance of youth or whoever the other individuals are. It might not be youth who are in the class space, the classroom community is what I call it. But whoever you happen to be working with, take for granted that you can learn more from that group than you can often even begin to convey. So I enter classroom spaces with an open heart and an open mind, ready and willing to learn. And I think just that dynamic, me coming in and saying, what can you all offer me? Here's what I can offer you, but I want to learn. I want to hear from you. Your stories are important. You are important. Your narrative is critically important to the nation, society, justice. For a student, so-called student, to come in and hear that really changes how they understand society, changes how they understand systems, changes how they dream about their own place in the world. So my co-creators, co-leaders of the class really contribute so much more because they know that they can. They know that they won't be criticized. They won't be looked down upon. They won't be oppressed. And they know that if I do engage in any of those behaviors, that it is incumbent upon them to call me in. I let them know that from day one. And that's the way that classroom community in my world operates. And I don't understand why that's not standard practice. So even with the Twitter chats that I've worked to develop with the students, centering their voices is really what that's about. It's not about like, oh, let's create a hashtag DefEd, you know, hashtag and just let it take off. And it's about like, how can we include these young folks who are the most impacted by all of our decision making and who always are the least involved in the decision making? How can we flip that on its head? And it's been really, really amazing to see the great advice that these young people have about what we can do differently. And the changes that they're offering up are easy, are so easy to do, and things that we as adults might not have even thought about simply because we're not in their space. We're not in their shoes. We're not seeing the world the way that they do. And I think everyone comes away a better human being as a result of that, just that exchange, that sense of, hey, we're all equal here. I can't imagine my world without them in it. And I think that's what education should be about. It's not about, oh, you know, teacher of the year, blah, blah, blah. It's about like classroom community of the century. That's how I see it.
It's nice to hear the way you both use the language of co-learners, co-leaders, co-creators. Actually, I don't think you said co-learner, but that you're using that language, but that you're also enacting that in a classroom community.
Yeah, thank you for that. Co-learners is completely adequate as well. So I like that. I like that language. And again, I'm always looking to learn more and add to and change. And And if someone were to come to me today and say, TL, that's an awful idea, and here's why. And if those points were valid, I'd say, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. And I would probably go back to my students and say, hey, I made a mistake. Here's what we were doing. Here's the feedback I received. And here's why I think maybe we should change that moving forward. What do you think? You know, and so those open conversations, the vulnerability is, and the humility, the ability to just say, you know, I think I might have messed up. It wasn't intentional, but I did. Here's what I'm going to do moving forward to change that. Here's what I'm going to do to try to rectify that. What do you all think? How can I do better? That's really all that people are looking for in these sorts of conversations. So it's a very interesting space to be in.
As you were talking, I was thinking, what is it that allows you to be this open to it? And I was thinking, you just must have so much confidence, but then you use the words humility and vulnerability. And I think, I mean, confidence has to be in there, but I think that the willing to be humble and willing to be vulnerable is what can allow you to open up and ask for critique and ask to work together to change what you're doing.
I consider it a gift to be shared with in a way that helps me improve myself and helps me improve the work that I'm doing and helps me improve society, right? Like, that's a gift. It's a gift to be able to hold yourself accountable to all of the communities to whom you can or have been doing harm, and or to whom you can avoid doing harm to, right? If someone comes in and says, here's how we can make sure that we don't oppress deaf blind people, you should be all open to that. I am. I think it's a beautiful gift. And I think if people could shift their understanding of what it means to be called in, called out even, that's really what's necessary to move all these conversations forward and to really advance all of our liberation.
Yeah, yeah. You have said that you're committed to creating a new world that is driven by love and radical inclusion. So you've talked about love and love and liberation. You've talked about love and love. I want to talk about inclusion a little bit. I want to talk about inclusion. The way we usually do inclusion, the way we generally in the U.S., especially in education, generally in the U.S., the most privileged groups will set the standards. The most privileged groups, this is what's normal or acceptable or good or not acceptable. We will get to decide. Who's inclusive, but if you can't, who's inclusive, or if you can't fit close enough to the standard, then you won't be included close enough to the standard. Even in an inclusive setting. Now, I want to hear your thoughts about what radical inclusion looks like and how it can be fostered.
I think we all have to do away with the notion that there is such a thing as normal. Normal is a problem and a privilege. It is a privilege to be considered normal in this society. It is a privilege to be considered includable in this society. It's a privilege to be able to determine who is includable and who is normal. And we have to start naming that. All of that ties back to ableism, racism, classism, trans antagonism, Islamophobia, right? Because all of those people who belong to any of those communities are not, quote unquote, normal. Radical inclusion means not having to think about inclusion ever, right? If you never have to think about who's included, who's the in-group, who's the other group, who's the out-group, the day that we can stop using words like diversity and inclusion would mean that we've arrived at radical inclusion.
That's the point where we don't have to go down checklists to see who have we made this a welcoming space for and who are we not. Well, actually, that's not what people usually ask. They usually ask, why aren't those people here? I thought we did outreach. So even the idea of let's outreach to these other communities we're not serving yet, even that is comes from the regular inclusion mindset, not the radical inclusion mindset.
Honestly, it is a dream world at this point, right? Radical inclusion is a practice. It's not a place. Regardless of where we are right now in this kind of battle to make sure that everyone is quote unquote included, it's just understanding that we'll never arrive there, which means that we'll always be in struggle. We'll always be working toward that, which means we'll always be humble and open and willing to understand how we can do better. One thing that I wanted to point out as related to this topic is about what you mentioned, this outreach. Why aren't those people who at the table, why aren't they at our table as opposed to like moving yourself to their table and like understanding and unpacking and doing all the work that's necessary to be in that space? But that's an uncomfortable space for so many people in privilege. And it doesn't matter what marginalized group you want to, you know, throw into this boat, but that's what it is. It's like, oh, well, they didn't show up. We invited them. They didn't come. But there's a lot of structural reasons why marginalized communities do not find their way to your table. And there's a lot of structural reasons why your table should be dismantled. And maybe we shouldn't have a table, because tables actually are not the most accessible spaces. Even that metaphor, right, is so problematic for so many reasons. Like maybe it's a bedroom space, or maybe it's the floor. Even just reimagining and reworking that language. It's an exercise in practicing critical intersectionality. It's an exercise in practicing denormalization of normal. And so I think these are all really good exercises and beginning steps into this process of unpacking why are we not yet critically intersectional, even in our most progressive, quote unquote, social justice spaces.
I'm just picturing like hacking down the table and making a fire pit and just stop. Like whose food were you planning on serving at the table?
Is there food at the table, or who gets the food? Right? Like, because of course you'd need to have some sort of monetary, which I mean, that goes all back to capitalism, right? And how jacked up, you know, all of this imperialist capitalism and all of these structures are. But yeah, throw the table into your fire pit. As long as there has to be a table, right, there's always going to be people who are left out. And it's really incredibly frustrating for me and other people who think like me. Like, I'm not the only person whose mind works the way that it does. There's a lot of us. But too often we're shunned, we're pushed away, we're told that we need to relax, we're told that we're too, you know, anxiety ridden, we're too dreamy, we're too aloof, or, you know, we're too, you know, I actually identify as a mad activist, mad in all of its connotations. My point is just that, you know, yeah, we just need to really be critical of ourselves, and we should start with the I statements and not the others. But the whole kind of outreach is such a problem, because you're never going to do the outreach in the way, especially nowadays with technology. People are really convinced that you post something on Facebook and everyone should know about it. And I'm like, hello, like the privilege, the sheer privilege of thinking that Twitter and Facebook as your only means of social outreach are going to reach the people that we need to reach. I just don't even have the words. The vast majority of all of our most marginalized communities are not in that space. And so instead of creating a table and saying, let's do outreach, go to them, find them, learn their languages, learn their cultures, be in their spaces, right? And that's what this should look like. But instead, it's the table that's not accessible, the door that's too narrow that the wheelchairs can't fit into, that doesn't have an interpreter around the table, that doesn't have tactile interpreting at the table, that doesn't have, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on. And so we really do need to undo our thoughts surrounding how outreach and inclusion should look, I guess.
Yeah. As we wrapped up the call, TL took advantage of the video chat to show me a gorgeous array of visual arts on the walls outside TL's office. We started with a new logo for Herd, which you can find as the banner image on Herd's Twitter. Then we moved to look at some work created by free deaf artists. The tour finished with many beautiful pieces created by deaf people who are incarcerated. One of Talila's deaf colleagues, who's a professor, and several other area deaf artists activists go into the prison and do art there with the artists who are incarcerated. We took turns describing the images out loud. Animals, trees, nature, hands, eyes, colorful swirls and spirals, all telling stories of a life behind bars. You can see some of the pieces I looked at by webcam at Patty Durr's blog, handseyes.wordpress.com, in the post from January 17th, 2016. Here's just a little bit of that tour.
I'm going to show you art from a deaf prisoner who's wrongfully convicted, who I've been working on his case for 10 years. He decided to revamp Herd's logo. His name is John Wilson, and this is the first case I ever worked on. He's the reason why I do all that I do. He's been incarcerated since September of 1994. He's still incarcerated in the federal system, and he is just an amazing human being. And this is what he decided to do for Herd. And that says freedom.
And so you've got the word Herd, the finger spelling it out.
The hands under the word Herd.
Mm-hmm. They are handcuffed, and they're kind of in between a prison.
Yep, and the handcuff, if you look at the chain, it's actually being broken. So that sign under the Herd is the sign for want. So he's saying, I want my freedom. I want my freedom. And there's a light in this tower, and the light is shining on the hands that are signing Herd. And this is a prison, and he says, but Herd is always behind the walls uplifting the community who's deaf incarcerated. And you should remember that the deaf community is very visual, and so many of them are beautiful artists, including deaf incarcerated people. So I'll show you some of the art from deaf incarcerated folks in this area.
A quick note, in our excitement, TL and I both left out a very important point here. When we talk about deaf community being very visual, we must always remember to name and honor that there are blind people in deaf community, deafblind people. And that while many in the community are visual and or tactile, some in the community are neither for various reasons. This should be honored. TL asked that I point this out, and I'm more than happy to do that.
So a lot of the themes in deaf art are hands, right? Obviously eyes, so you'll see eyeballs, lots of eyes, and trees, and ladders. And these primary colors are pretty critically important in deaf art, but always hands.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important. Now understand, these deaf prisoners don't have any kind of innate knowledge of deaf art and what that should be. But the things that they did were so tied to what these artists did that it's really like, oh my God, of course, like we're a community, and like linking that humanity for these deaf artists who are free people, they can't stop. So they go now like twice a month. They are in prison more than me. So let's see.
And is that a beehive hanging out of that
mm-hmm.
tree?
A beehive, birds, animals. One of the deaf incarcerated folks who's also innocent, Felix Garcia, he was moved to a different prison at some point. He said, I saw a tree for the first time in 25 years. He said, all I could do was cry and hug it, right? I don't think free people, again, I created this concept called freedom privilege. It's something that's not discussed, but it needs to be, because we're really missing a huge swath of what it means to be privileged. So understand, deaf incarcerated people who are being completely abused all the time, this is what they came up with. And it's like, truly, like, they're humans. And I don't understand why people don't understand that. Here's another one. This one's really sad. Let me see if you can see it.
Oh, this person's got their hands chained and they're covering their mouth, and the guards are there screaming behind the person.
Mm-hmm. And they don't have ears, right? So they're indicating, I'm deaf, and the guards don't let them sign.
So they have no voice with hands or mouth.
Nope. No communication.
Oh, wow.
And then this is the octopus. You'll find eyes all throughout this one.
Is the octopus in prison?
Well, there's if you look at it, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
So there are two eyes here and hands. So I don't know if that's the octopus itself, another octopus, or if that's this person imagining themselves.
Oh, yeah.
There's, it's pretty intricate. You just have to pay close attention, and it's easier if you're actually here.
And what a smile. The octopus has a huge smile.
Yeah. So, yeah. This is the community building that I do. Oh, and this last one. This is from a deaf returned person, a person who got out of prison. So this is the sign for arrest. So grabbing hands. It's also like if you want to stop a deaf person from communicating, you'll grab their hands. So it says society's barriers to deaf is arrest is prison. And then you can see eyes again, the motif of eyes and the fingers. And there's a poem here. But the last thing I'll tell you, which is really, really sad and interesting, is that different sign languages are actually developed in prison systems because they're so isolated. So in the same way back in the days of segregation, you probably don't know, during segregation, Black deaf people developed sign languages and white deaf people really were forced oral, but some of them had their own sign too. And then when integration happened, Black people were expected to drop their language, pick up ASL, and move forward like nothing happened. So there's a lot of issues around that, but which of course meant Black people now were behind again and playing catch up. In the prison system, because interpreters refuse to go in, the community kind of just abandons them. If there's multiple deaf people in a prison system, they tend to develop their own language. And then also because deaf, our community is really visual, like so my sign names here compared to when I go to Guatemala are different. So in Guatemala, because my skin is darker than everyone, this is actually my sign name, right? And so, or here it's TL, that's my sign name here in the US. The reason I brought all that up is because my brain does associative leaps. This poem is a deaf person who was released, but right before he was released, explaining the scenario in the prison that all of these people are housed in. And he uses the word greens, uses the word white and different colors to indicate people. And so whereas in Louisiana, if you ask a deaf prisoner, what's the sign for inmate there? It's this. And that's because inmate is written right on the side of their clothes. So inmate is it indicates who you're talking about. Here, where I am when I visit deaf prisoners, the sign for inmate is green. Like literally the color, because that's the color of their clothes. So they call each other green. So if they're talking about a prisoner, they'll say inmate. The sign for inmate is actually green. The sign for a CO, who's kind of higher up, is white, and blue for a more working class CO because they wear blue. And so just very interesting different languages that develop because of the isolation. So it's not good at all, but just different things that most people don't even realize. So yeah, so that's my, these are my family.
Oh man, thank you for introducing me to their art at least.
Yeah, so now you have it.
TL also asked me to add that these intra-prison signs sometimes are closer to the free deaf community's creation of regional signs, so it's not always the full creation of languages. Especially now, there's so much technology that allows a bit more interaction between free and incarcerated people than even just a few years ago.
I appreciate your work. I appreciate the way you do it. I appreciate what you say. I appreciate you reminding me about love. Because I will forget that when I just want to be angry at everybody. And so I'm very grateful for the time and the energy you've given to talk to me today. Would you let people know where they can find you online?
So I have a new blog that I'm now going to post some older articles on. So the blog is TalilaLewis.com, T-A-L-I-L-A. I also am on Twitter at T-A-L-I-L-A Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Talila Lewis. And I think those are the best places to follow my work. If you're interested in following my organizational work with HERD, you can go on to Facebook and follow us at facebook.com/HERD, H-E-A-R-D, D-C, as in District of Columbia. Or you can follow us on Twitter at BEHEARDDC, BHERDDC.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time and your generosity. Thank you.
For indulging me and listening. Oh. I appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You have been listening to Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland. Many thanks again to our engineer, Adam. We always welcome new collective members, and if you're interested in joining as a producer, host, or engineer, no experience necessary, please contact KBOO's volunteer coordinator at volunteer@kboo.org or reach out to us at breadandroses@kboo.org. You can connect with us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/breadandroses, like us on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses, and we are on Twitter at Bread Roses Radio. We're going to go out with the song We Know Here by Def Rappers Wawa and Show Rock. Have a good night, everyone.
Ain't hearing cause I can't, yo, you feel right. I'll keep dealing with sadness. Can't read or write, yo, you kidding me? Peep this. 28 million bucks, get a game on. Yeah, 28, you heard, that's a lot, huh? Our time is now, ain't gonna hold back. A silent storm is coming, you're gonna get slapped. How you gonna fly? You only feel beat. Who said you gotta hear to make you see? Watch the sign that's made for your eyes. Throw your ass out, let's go by, taking over. No way to say what, back up, okay? I ain't hear that, we're here to stay. From the death tribe, take you on a ride. Drop it like a sock for the rock when it soothes ya.
Title put down, let's turn this around. Made the world know that it stops right here. We gotta fly our hell held up high. And letting you know that we know here.
Spick necked, I'm like Iron Man. Your words bounce off, still standing with a smile. Hand blast, you swagger, I'm scragging by. Slick hands, kick a wiggle, hypnotize. I'm like bone at a crime scene.
Hey, this is KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. You've been listening to